This is your host, Silas Dean, and this is a Creep Time original podcast, The Sinister. So make sure to go check out Creep Time, the podcast, right after this show.
Well, you can't trust County.
There are a lot of cases in the genre of true crime that sort of cover, as a lot of people would say, all of the bases, right? They're spine-chilling or they keep you up at night, but there are none quite like this story for me. The Axeman of New Orleans. Something about this is entirely different. And if I had to put, you know, sort of a reason behind it, I would say it's mostly the method of the kill. This is somebody, more often than not, who was seeking to kill people, unsuspecting, seemingly at random, in the middle of the night when they were asleep in their own homes. And the most chilling part was that he very rarely came with his own murder weapon. He would often use things that are in your house. To this day, his identity remains an unknown. So who was behind it? Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of The Sinister with Silas. I'm your host, Silas Dean, and every week I come right on here. I hang out with you right after an episode of Creep Time, the podcast, and I cover the eeriest stories that I know. So please follow and subscribe to the podcast and turn on the bell notification so that you never have to miss an episode. And I would also appreciate a review and if you could share the podcast to help support the stories of The Sinister. Thanks again for stopping by. And with that, let's get into the story. Now, I'm going to jump into this full throttle. I'm going to give everybody some backstory. But before I do, I don't usually do this in The Sinister. We usually reserve this for Creep Time or, you know, Creep Time After Dark. But Creep Time, the podcast, Stu and I, for anybody who doesn't know, we are coming to Las Vegas, September 13th, 2024. We are playing a live show. The pre-sale kicked off. It sold out almost immediately, so we had to open up additional rows outside of the pre-sale. General sale started May 1st, so there are still tickets available. It's going to be a night of true crime. It's going to be a lot of laughs. Surprisingly, we're going to find ways to create levity. We're going to show hidden pictures, things about our backstory that you may not know, live Q&As, contests, giveaways, and meet and greets. So whether you want a VIP ticket or you want to just come hang for a quick drink, $25, make sure that you check the link in the description so you can come out to Vegas, enjoy your weekend, and come see Creep Time live. Now with that, now we can jump into the story. So for a little bit of backstory here, I'm going to take us all the way back to 1918. I feel like we don't cover many cases that go back that far. When you usually think about serial killers, you think about the serial killer boom. You know, everybody talks about it from the 60s, the 70s. People don't talk about the earlier part of the 20th century. 1918, New Orleans. Over a period of 18 to 20 months, someone held a reign over that city. They would later be known as the Axeman. So to paint the picture of one of the first kills that is known of the Axeman, we focus in on May 23rd, 1918. This is 4901 Magnolia Street, where something horrific took place in the middle of the night. Now, Catherine and Joseph Maggio, a married couple, lived in this home, and they also lived there with Joseph's brothers. Joseph's brothers ended up being the two who would discover the couple by the following morning. They walked into the bedroom, where what they saw took their breath away. Both of them had been struck violently with an axe, and both had been slit with some kind of a razor blade across their throats, Catherine so deeply her head was nearly entirely decapitated. There was virtually nothing in the home that seemed out of place, right? There were no valuables that were stolen. None of the belongings seemed to have been taken. But what they did notice, police and the brothers, while they searched the premises, the bottom panel of the kitchen door had been basically punched in. So we're presuming that somebody had punched in, used their arm to reach up and unlock the door from inside. Now, surprisingly, despite us knowing that this happened, nobody seemed to hear or see anything that night. So we have to assume when they were both struck, it happened while they were asleep. They were completely ambushed, and there is no feasible reason why these two were the first victims. It seemed completely randomized, which made it all the more chilling. Who would have done this, and why would they do it to a random couple? This would mark the very first known attack of the Axeman of New Orleans. But whoever he wasn't finished. So initially, this had just sort of become a story, right? Locally, people were sort of terrified of it, but nobody really suspected that this would be a repeat offender until we fast forward to about a month later. This is June 28th, 1918, where again, the Axeman would strike. Now, the next victims in the attack, Louis Bessemer and Anna Lowe, were another couple, and they were actually discovered by a morning delivery man who found them in a grisly state. And surprisingly, both of them had initially survived, and this is instrumental to the case for two reasons. One, because we would soon conclude this is a serial killer, or at least an attempted serial killer. He intended to kill these people, but the survival meant that we had our first witnesses to who the Axeman was. Now, as mentioned, Lewis would go on to survive long term, but Anna, because of the state of her injuries, would only survive for the next 7 weeks. But before she died, she was able to give her witness statement to police because she was the one of the two who remembered most of the attack and the night. She described a very tall, ominous figure, definitely male, standing over them before they were attacked, holding a hatchet. It's believed it was a hatchet that was found in or on their premises, and the bottom panel to their bedroom door was again punched out. I don't know how it is that they didn't hear that. Maybe they did, and in the midst of the attack and, you know, the aftermath of the recovery, they didn't remember that they heard it, because Anna was definitely awake for a portion of this. She saw the attacker. But her witness statements were paramount to the case. Suddenly, there was a boogeyman who was running around New Orleans, and no one had a name. And what I also think is interesting about this particular kill or attempted kill was that, again, he left the weapon at the scene. Just like the first victims, he left the axe right at the scene. So there's something going on there. In my point of view, I think there's something psychologically going on there with this guy where he has this compulsion to kill, these violent, violent methods of killing, and he's using weapons from inside the house. It's almost opportunistic in a sick way. But then once he's done with it, once he's riding the high and it comes down, he almost immediately tries to shed himself of whatever he just did. He leaves the weapon at the scene. He takes no valuables. He doesn't want a memento. So something else is going on with him internally, if I had to guess, in my professional true crime opinion. But then again, a month later, we are going to get our third known attack from the Axeman. Now, I believe this attack was a little bit different. This was a woman who was alone. I believe she was found midday and she was pregnant at the time of her attack. So that is putting us into a whole other territory of sinister here. We're talking about a man who does not care who he goes after. He does not care who he harms, which is obvious from attacking people who are sleeping, attacking people who don't see it coming, and specifically attacking a pregnant woman. Her name was Mrs. Ed Schneider, and she was actually found by her husband midday. So the timing of this is also a little bit different from the previous two attacks. She was immediately rushed to the hospital, where not only did she survive, her child also was delivered and survived the attack. So now we've got three known survivors who initially survived their attacks of the Axeman. And while in my research, I wasn't able to dig up very much about what she remembered, and it's, how can you possibly ask that of somebody who's gone through the most traumatic thing they will ever go through, an attempted murder? She did not remember much, but what they did learn from the scene was that, again, an axe was missing from their shed. So again, he is going to these people's homes, and opportunistically, he is just expecting to find a weapon, something he is going to kill somebody with. And I don't even know if he knows who he's going to go after. I think it's that spur of the moment for this guy. But it was not long after this that we would get yet another attack from the Axeman. This is the fourth known attack. It came against Joseph Romano. He was an older man, solo, attacked solo, which again is different from what we've seen before, in his 80s. So again, this person, whoever is attacking them, does not discriminate. Women, children, the elderly, he does not care. He will go after anyone. What's different about this attack is that Joseph does die. He only survives the first 48 hours because allegedly his head was almost entirely bashed in. But I would say what separates this are the witness statements. his two nieces found him, which of course you can imagine was grisly and traumatic. But what's different about this is that they actually saw him in the middle of the attack. They saw the Axeman. This is kind of our first witness statement of anyone who wasn't on the receiving end of the attack. They said he was tall, very heavy set. He was kind of looming, ominous look to his face, his eyes. And he wore a black suit and a dark colored hat. And of course, he carried with him an axe. A chilling image, but arguably, I mean, the most helpful and really the first proper witness account other than saying he's a male looming figure in the dark. Sort of this boogeyman-esque silhouette that we're playing to. The Axeman did get away, despite these witnesses, but again, this is really reshaping New Orleans into something else at this time. You know, this is between August through the next few months, going into the fall of 1918, where everybody, every family is on high alert. I mean, we're talking about entire families staying up all night. How can you go to sleep knowing that it's completely randomized? He doesn't go after anyone in particular. Single men, single women, children. I mean, entire families in your sleep. Fathers were staying up all night on their porches with guns, assuming that their house could be next. The Axeman might just show up, unlock a door, and go after you. I can't even imagine, you know, these scenarios like this. I know, like, I think a lot about the, because I live in Los Angeles, I think a lot about the Night Stalker and this sort of scenario of somebody who's on the loose. They don't know who it is. They don't know where he's going to strike next. He seems to have no real motive, no real agenda. He is just going after anyone. There is so much fear for me in that. It's also because I live in a ground floor apartment. I would so genuinely leave a city. It would take virtually nothing for me to pick up and just abandon. Like, I would absolutely leave a city. Are you kidding? That's so scary. That's so scary to me. But again, even though this is technically the fourth attack on record, it is not the last. Now, there is a period here, kind of a lull, where there's about 7 months of quiet. And I think that was because after the fourth attack, that was when everybody in New Orleans was kind of on that high alert, right? People were staying up all night. People got guns. The police were searching left and right. But it's sort of, you know, we've seen patterns like this before. And arguably, I mean, this is a very early case of a serial killer. But there seems to be like a lull where they just kind of go quiet once everybody's in high alert. And the second that everybody lets their guard down, they come back. And that's exactly what happened 7 months later with the Cortomiglia family, family of three who were attacked in the middle of the night. One of the last witness statements of this attack actually came from the wife, Rose Cortomiglia, who woke up and found her husband, Charles, in a fight with the Axeman. He's in their bedroom with an axe. She said that was the last thing that she remembered before she saw Charles get hacked away, and then she was next. But also, their two-year-old daughter, who was in the home, sleeping. Now, Rose and her husband, miraculously, despite their injuries, would survive these attacks. Their two-year-old daughter, Mary, did not. This is a person on the loose in New Orleans who knows no bounds. He has no moral compass in any of this. Again, we keep coming back to this where he does not care who he goes after, but we still don't really know outside of that one, you know, one or two visual descriptions, who he is, what's going on inside his head. That all changes once we receive an anonymous letter, allegedly from the Axeman himself. Now, this letter was received just 5 days after that last attack, and it was sent in to a New Orleans newspaper, and the headline of it read, "Hell, March 13th, 1919. The letter read as follows: "Esteemed mortal, they have never caught me, and they never will. They have never seen me, for I am invisible, even as the ether which surrounds your earth. I am not a human being, but a spirit and a fell demon from hottest hell. I am what you Orleanians and your foolish police call the Axeman. They have been so utterly stupid so as to amuse not only me, but his satanic majesty. But tell them to beware. Let them not try to discover what I am
for it were better that they were never born than for them to incur the wrath of the Axeman. Now, believe it or not, this does go on for a little bit more. He has a few other clauses, but I want to focus in on what I think is the most chilling of this letter. He says, "Now, to be exact, at 12:15 o'clock earthly time on next Tuesday night, I am going to pass over New Orleans. In my infinite mercy, I am going to make a little proposition to the people. Here it is. I am very fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared in whose house a jazz band is in full swing at the time I have just mentioned. If everyone has a jazz band going, well then, so much the better for the people. One thing is certain, and that is some of those persons who do not jazz it on Tuesday night, if there be any, will get the axe."
Okay. There's so much to unpack with that. This is clearly somebody, in my point of view, I think this is some sort of an elevated, like, spiritual psychosis where they think that they're in communication with the devil, but he's also power hungry. He likes the fear that he's kind of created over people. And that's something that's common. We see that with a lot of serial killers where they sort of reach out and have a relationship to the media. They're using the press as a tool for notoriety. He wants to see just how impactful his reign has become. And as expected, on March 19th, 1919, it was a terrifying Tuesday night. The entire city was described to be up all night, blasting jazz music in everyone's house. People who didn't have record players were terrified. Many of them were reported to be at clubs till the morning hours. Some of them slept over at jazz clubs. The entire city just basically rang with music all night. And true to his word, the Axeman did not show up. I mean, mostly for obvious reasons that, of course, if he's saying there is a specific night where I'm going to go out and kill, police are going to be on high alert. So why would he go out and kill? It's more so a test for my POV, where he just wanted to see a true expression of the mass fear in the city. How many people are terrified that they're going to be next? I can't even imagine like what something like that must be like at a local level. I'm trying to think of what that night was like, sitting in your home all night with just the record player blasting jazz music, your father sitting in the corner with a shotgun, just waiting and hoping all night. That is so scary. People don't talk about this story enough. Like sometimes when I look at these older cases, I'm like, do people know about this? This is insane to me. But again, this is another case of sort of the peak of public terror, right? And public awareness, where suddenly he hits another lull. He goes quiet for a period of months because we don't really see another attack from the Axeman until August of 1919. This was a solo man, Steve Boca, who woke up and next to his bed in the middle of the night, all these months after all this silence, was the Axeman, crouching and ready to attack. Now, Boca did end up surviving this attack, although his memory of the attack is very touch and go. He does not remember much of seeing the actual features of the man, but he did remember it was just one man. That's important for a little bit later. There would be a follow-up attack of another person. It was a woman. She was solo. She would also end up surviving this. And then this is considered the second-to-last attack until we reach the final attack that is known or believed to have been known of the Axeman. And it's a little different than all of the attacks that came before. Now, this took place a couple of months after the second-to-last attack. This is October 27th, still 1919, and this was the Peppertone family. They woke up in the middle of the night, sometime around midnight, 1 a.m, where Esther, the wife, basically saw her husband struck in the head close to 20 times, 18 straight hits with an axe. He would die. She would survive the attack. And that was invaluable because although this is the last known attack, what she saw was very different from what came before. There were now two men in the room. One who she described and is believed to be the Axeman, and then a mysterious other male figure who was with him. It's believed there was only
one significant weapon that was found at the scene that kind of gave us a clue into who might have been the new accomplice, because nobody else had described anything like this before. It is believed to be that the Axeman was one singular person who was operating solo. However, that left behind weapon was some kind of a tent stake. But not only a tent stake, it was one that was specific to a circus tent. A circus, which was in New Orleans at the time. So I have to assume, or beg the question, was the Axeman looking to basically extend his reign by recruiting new people? Did he go to the circus? Did he talk to carnies? Did he talk to people, or maybe even just a few men, who he was trying to rope into this lifestyle? I don't really understand what this phase is of a serial killer where suddenly they want to branch out to sort of extend their terror, or they find a sense of lonesomeness in the terror, so they try to rope somebody else into it. And it's not even clear if the other person was there to watch, if they actually attacked. They certainly brought some kind of a weapon. That's what we think they left. But since this is the last attack, we don't really know what happens to them in this context of him having an accomplice. Did this person just bear witness to it, and then did he kill them? You know, it's sort of left out as a mystery, but even after this all dies down, after 1919, we're still left without answers. To this day, there is no known person who is truly, truly suspected and has been connected to the Axeman killings of New Orleans. And of course, there are theories that we could go through. We could talk about the theories about this being connected to the mob, and maybe these were mob hits, or maybe it was a slew of copycat killers. There are even a few names that are tossed around as potential suspects, but truthfully, when you look at all of it with a bird's eye view and knowing what we know about the case, everything I just covered, most of it is circumstantial evidence. And I think the most concrete point of evidence here that this belonged to one singular monster was really that letter, if we're to believe it's true. But I can't imagine even a copycat killer would write something so grotesque and then never be caught for it. You know, this was a person who was doing so, and doing so in a calculated way so they could remain elusive. And to this day, the mystery persists. It is an unsolved case. Over that 18-month period, who was running around New Orleans in the middle of the night, breaking into people's bedrooms and trying to hack them to death? So that is our story. Thank you for listening to all of that. I know it is a grisly case, but my God, you never hear about that. So I'm talking about, like, a lot of these older stories, especially in the true crime world, people forget about these cases. They don't know, like, they think about serial killers. I kind of alluded to this in the beginning of the show, but they think about serial killers and you think about, like, the Ted Bundys and the Manson family. You think about, like, the big figures from the 70s and 80s, right? Like the Night Stalker types. You do not think about these elusive characters that go back hundreds of years. This case is over 100 years old. That's really hard to think about just how much terror somebody could inflict on a community when you don't have forensics, when you don't have a police force that's used to dealing with something like this. I mean, we have that even to this day. If you listen to Creep Time, you know that you can't trust county. But with that said, I want to say thank you, guys. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sinister. I have thoroughly enjoyed getting to refresh myself on this case because I think I knew the top line of it, but I really didn't know too many details about the actual attacks, and God, is it chilling. So I appreciate you listening. Make sure that you follow and subscribe so you can stick around for another episode that will come out probably next weekend. And don't forget, check the link in the description if you want to come out to enjoy Creep Time Live for a night of true crime in Las Vegas, September 13th, 2024. I'll see you guys there, and I'll catch you on the next one. Bye.